He thought of himself as a real China expert. In fact, he used to refer to himself as the China head officer of the China desk for the United States government.
A national day of mourning for a U.S. president with ties to China. It's Wednesday, December 5th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, talking through trade differences, a desire to end the arms race, the business of trains, scrubbing air pollution, and bees taking a break. It's all on today's VOA Asia. President Donald Trump has declared today a national day of mourning for former U.S. President George H.W. Bush, who died Friday at his home in Houston at age 94. One of the lesser-known chapters in the life of President Bush was the year he and his wife spent in China in 1974 and 1975. While in Beijing, the former president kept a diary of his life there. Jeffrey Engel, the director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, got to know the former U.S. president well. Together with Bush, he turned the diary into a published book titled The China Diary of George H.W. Bush, The Making of a Global President. Engel also traveled with the Bushes when the president and his wife Barbara returned to China in 2005. VOA Asia's Ira Melman sat down with Engel and asked him why and how the Bushes went to China.
Well, he was U.S. de facto ambassador to China in the early 1970s, and the de facto part is really important. This is, of course, before the United States and China developed formal relations in 1979, but after Nixon went to China, open China, if you will, from the American perspective, earlier in the decade, Bush had been at the United Nations and then went and became head of the Republican National Committee for Richard Nixon, but took that job right before Watergate broke. Spent the next year or so basically trying to defend the president, even though he increasingly came to decide that the president was guilty, like the rest of the nation agreed. And then subsequently, really wanted to get out of Washington. And Gerald Ford, the president, gave him the offer of going either to Paris or to London as ambassador. He knew Bush was interested in foreign policy. And Bush, to everyone's surprise, including Barbara Bush's, turned around and said, actually, I'd rather go to Beijing. It sounds like a much more interesting place to be. And frankly, it's further away from Washington and I need a rest.
And there was no diplomatic relations between the two countries at that time. Is that right?
We had a liaison office. It was basically an ambassador in all but name and in all but rank. So they did all the same things that an embassy or a consulate would do. But they would traditionally, the Chinese, when they would have events, would traditionally rank all of the different ambassadors in terms of importance when they would line up for handshakes or whatnot. And the United States is typically at the top of the list. Well, because we were not formally an embassy, Ambassador Bush was at the bottom of the list, if you will. In fact, he used to stand way at the back of the line and have nice conversations with the director of the Palestinian Liberation Organization representative in Beijing. Basically, it gives you a sense that they knew the Americans were obviously the great superpower, but legally, technically, in a bureaucratic, diplomatic sense, still had to pretend that they did not have formal relations.
I have read in some of the material associated with the diaries that he was frustrated by not being able to meet the highest level of Chinese society and government, I should say.
He did. I mean, Bush's entire perspective on politics and on life, and he did this in business, and he did this in every facet of his existence, was to try to make personal connections. He believed that if you knew somebody and had a connection with them that went beyond what you were working on, that you'd be able to work together better. So when he went to China, he really had a vision that he would be sitting down and having tea every week with Deng or with Mao Zedong. It was just simply wasn't going to happen. He had unrealistic expectations, but also was frustrated further down the food chain, if you will, that this is a period in Chinese history immediately after the Cultural Revolution, of course. It's unclear in what direction reform is going to go or if there's going to be reform. And Bush perceived that people were just generally uncomfortable meeting with Americans unless they had a good reason to do so, that there was more downside, if you will, for somebody in the government to have a conversation with him than there could be upside.
So what was he able to accomplish there?
He spent a lot of time on sabbatical. to be completely honest. This was a great moment for him to get away from Washington and rest up. He actually spent a lot of time not with Chinese officials, but with the rest of the diplomatic community. And there's a real sense in which he would spend time with the French ambassador, with the Belgian ambassador, with other diplomats from around the world, other business people from around the world. And I think it really helped him perceive a global perspective, that because Bush was so interested, as I mentioned before, in getting to know people, he would listen to people. And he would spend time at ping pong, spend time at tennis, spend time in the club, talking and listening. And I think it really broadened his horizons.
There's a story about he and Barbara walking his dog when they got there. Can you relate that story?
I don't actually remember the dog walking story per se.
They had never seen.
Yeah, I was going to say.
They did
all kinds of things that were not expected. But the other thing that future President Bush did that really endeared him to the Chinese was he would, like every other Beijinger, he would ride his bicycle. He had a special bicycle made that was his size, of course. He was a very tall man, and he and Barbara would tool around the town just like everybody else and go into traffic like everyone else. And this was something that many Chinese officials really couldn't fathom a foreign ambassador doing. That was in some ways cute, in some ways beneath his station, but in all ways very endearing, that it really represented that Bush wanted to get out as much as possible within the country.
How did this affect his relationship with China then when he was elected president?
It affected it greatly in a way I think that shines positively on Bush's legacy, and then also a way that I think we can question for Bush's legacy. He knew some of the officials from his earlier time. He had met them at least, Deng Xiaoping most importantly, and he therefore felt that he could create a personal relationship while president, that he wrote personal letters to top Chinese officials and wanted to get them on the telephone. They actually rarely, if ever, spoke to him on the telephone. And in a sense, he thought of himself, and this is the negative part, he thought of himself as a real China expert. In fact, he used to refer to himself as the China head officer of the China desk for the United States government, that he would handle China policy. The truth of the matter is, I think any fair assessment would point out that Bush was not an actual China expert. He had been there for a year and a half. He didn't know the language. He didn't know the history very well, didn't know the culture very well, but he thought he did. And so therefore, when he was president, he thought he could work with Chinese leaders in a one-on-one, personalized way that really never panned out over the course of his presidency.
Did he mention that in the diaries?
The diaries are from the 70s, and then also he had diaries, of course, later on. He mentioned the fact that he thought he knew China. He mentioned the fact that he was an expert on China when he became president. James Baker, who was the Secretary of State, said in his memoirs, for example, that he was comfortable, Baker, working on the Soviet Union and working on Europe because he knew that President Bush was essentially in charge of China, in charge of Asia from the American perspective. And again, that was really problematic because he really did not know the major players and know the major scene as much as he thought he did.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Jeffrey Engel, the director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU in Dallas. Former U.S. President George H.W. Bush will be remembered at a ceremony inside Washington's National Cathedral before his body is returned to Texas for burial Thursday. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. President Trump says trade talks with China underway. Boat carrying Rohingya Muslims lands in Indonesia's Sumatra Island. Experts unsure of outcomes ahead of possible Kim visit to Seoul, second summit with Trump. Cambodia eases pressure on opposition media after EU sanctions threat. Food scandals push Vietnamese to seek solutions. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also visit the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Now that the United States and China have reached a truce on their trade war, questions remain about whether the world's two largest economies will be able to achieve a more extensive and definitive deal within the 90 days agreed time frame. Patsy Whitaker-Suara brings us this report from the White House.
Stock markets responded positively after the U.S. and China agreed not to impose any new tariffs for the next 90 days while they resolve deep differences and craft a detailed trade agreement. But the two countries offered few details beyond their official statements. White House officials say China vows to move immediately to lift tariff and non-tariff barriers and agrees to over $1 trillion of additional trade commitments.
These things depend on market conditions, as you can imagine. Consumer demands, the state of the economies. The one thing that's really important to me, at least, is reducing the tariffs on these items. That, to me, that's a, quote, structural change, along with reducing non-tariff barriers.
How quickly Beijing delivers will show how serious it is in reaching a deal.
Xi Jinping appears ready to make some very clear, concrete moves that might satisfy the Trump administration. But we can't see this from looking at the respective joint statements because those are very, very different. There's really nothing concrete in the Chinese statement at all.
Analysts see the potential of China opening up its markets, including automobiles and financial services. But Beijing is unlikely to give everything Washington is asking. Ultimately, President Trump may have to accept a compromise, says analysts.
I think there's a pretty good chance because as you get to the middle of 2019, the U.S. economy is likely to be slowing, and it'll be in the interest of the administration to accept some kind of deal rather than ratchet up the trade war again.
Although China has broken past commitments, U.S. officials say negotiations have never gone this far, and both sides understand how much is at stake.
I think President Trump and President Xi have developed a very important relationship. I think as the two largest economies, they both understand the responsibilities that we have.
If Washington and Beijing are unable to reach an agreement by March 1st, the Trump administration plans to raise tariffs to 25%. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Happening in Asia, a boat carrying 20 men believed to be Rohingya Muslims has landed on Indonesia's Sumatra Island, the latest in a growing wave attempting to flee persecution in Myanmar. Myanmar authorities have recently been stopping scores of boats filled with Rohingya migrants attempting to sail to Malaysia. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. President Donald Trump said he wants to end the arms race. In a tweet Monday, Mr. Trump, at some time in the future, said President Xi Jinping, President Vladimir Putin of Russia, will start talking about, in his words, a meaningful halt to what has become a major and uncontrollable arms race. He said the $716 billion the United States spent on defense this year is, quote, crazy. Speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty, John Tierney, executive director of the Washington-based Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, agrees, but said the president is partly to blame.
I think he's right that it's crazy that this country spent $716 billion, but he's as much to blame for it as anybody else. He signed the bill, and he didn't really come back with any alternatives, of which there are plenty. And if he's talking about an arms race that he seems uncontrollable, well, he's aiding and abetting that ability. He can certainly participate in controlling it. The United States always had a leadership role in doing that since the days of Ronald Reagan, and he and John Bolton and company have sort of abdicated that. So I think we should encourage him to have those conversations. We should think about it. The sooner it starts, the better. He ought to do it at a high level with people that understand what they're doing. That we have diplomats that have experience in this area, that are knowledgeable. He just can't go about it as he's been prone to do in the past, sitting down himself and thinking that the three principals are going to chat it out without doing an awful lot of groundwork and having a lot of people that are very, very knowledgeable about these areas get involved and start working on it.
Do you see a possible opening that would make the presidents of China and Russia amenable to such talks?
I do. Look, even back in the days when Ronald Reagan thought that Russia was the evil empire, and we had any number of disputes and disagreements with that country, that is the Soviet Union, they found a way to separate out the existential issue of nuclear weapons. This is a serious thing that can affect humanity. So we have to be able to do that. And even though we have disagreements with Russia and some contention on trade and other issues with China, we certainly can carve out this issue, the existential threat of nuclear weapons and mistake or miscalculation or other things can go wrong, and start addressing those. And we ought to do that because it opens up a path to have conversations about a host of other things as well. But this is a serious matter, and Most people who, you know, in this country would love to see some serious negotiations to start to try to decrease the nuclear arsenals, and in fact, the entire arsenals of these countries, and start moving back to the path that we had been on for decades until more recently.
Isn't the president on record as advocating a modernization of the nuclear program?
He's on record. Some Democrats and Republicans are on record. The idea is if you are talking about making sure that what you have as a deterrent is safe and secure, that's one aspect of modernization. And I think people can say, well, if you still believe in deterrence and that's your path, then you do want to make sure things are safe and secure. But if you're using modernization as a ruse to just have an arms race, to have more weapons of different components and different degrees of magnitude, and move in that direction, then modernization is not what should be happening.
John Tierney said rather than threatening to withdraw from the 1987 Intermediate Forces Nuclear Treaty with Moscow, the Trump administration should engage the Russians over its concerns of treaty violations. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia, U.S. President Donald Trump said in a series of tweets Tuesday that talks to secure a trade deal with China have already started and, quote, if a fair deal is reached, I will happily sign it. Trump added the negotiations with China have already begun and hinted the 90-day discussion period might be extended. Extend your visit to VOA Asia Facebook as long as you like. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, North and South Korea seek to link rail lines, while China upgrades rail travel in Argentina. Skylar Ogden is on track with these stories on today's VOA Asia Business Scene.
A South Korean train recently pulled into North Korea for the first time in a decade. On board were several South Korean officials who, with their North Korean counterparts, will be conducting surveys to link the railway lines between the two countries. South Korea's unification minister, Cho Myung-gyun.
Through the One Connected Railway, South and North Korea will prosper together, and the ground for peace on the Korean Peninsula will be consolidated. The trains running on the track will also carry peace and prosperity with them to Northeast Asia and the world.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in have held several diplomatic missions this year in an effort to ease rising tensions about the North's nuclear ambitions. Although Washington and Pyongyang have reached a stalemate in their efforts to solve the nuclear standoff, both Kim and Moon have agreed to foster economic cooperation and remain hopeful that international sanctions will be lifted. Cho Myung-gyun.
We will closely consult with the relevant countries going forward to make sure the inter-Korean railway connection project can proceed with the support of the international community.
The joint railway survey plan had been put on hold until recently when the UN Security Council granted sanctions exemptions. The Unification Ministry says that officials will inspect two routes in North Korea, between Kaesong and Sinuiju in the west and Mount Kumgang and the Tumen River in the east, which will ultimately be linked to the south. In more railway news, the Argentine government signed an agreement with state-owned company China Railway Construction Corporation to start the first phase of an upgrade project on the San Martin railway network. The San Martin network in Argentina connects the province of Mendoza and Buenos Aires and ensures the rail freight transport in the country. This is the longest railway project undertaken by a Chinese enterprise in Latin America and is one of several Chinese infrastructure projects across the continent. China has also expanded trade and military ties and provided aid to several governments in the Latin American region. It has also issued billions of dollars in commodities-backed loans across the Americas, helping to open a large share of the region's oil for China to buy. The latest railway project in Argentina will help to increase annual freight traffic and the competitiveness of the transportation system in the country. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. Cambodia's parliament is reviewing a 5-year ban on more than 100 members of the main opposition party, which could allow them to return to politics following threats by the European Union to deny duty-free trading access to the Southeast Asian nation. Visit VOA Asia Facebook and return often. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, pollution in the world's lakes, rivers, and bays is creating conditions in which algae thrive, but other forms of life suffer. Scientists have found they can put those algae to work cleaning up that pollution and help generate clean power in the process. VOA's Steve Barragona visited the Port of Baltimore to see how it works.
Polluted water flows down this shallow channel. It comes out of the Chesapeake Bay here at the Port of Baltimore. But polluted is just how the algae lining the channel like it, says University of Maryland scientist Peter May.
Nature sometimes isn't pretty, but it's always pretty. This is what's doing all the work for us right here. That gives us the production that allows us to remove more nutrients from the water.
Around the world, excess nutrients from farm fertilizers and city wastewater set off massive growth of algae. These giant blooms can often be seen from space. But the algal turf scrubber, as the system is called, harnesses those microbes to do good.
Essentially creating a controlled algal bloom on land, which put the algae to work, pulling nutrients out of the water body.
Durham, North Carolina is planning to help clean up a local reservoir with a scrubber. Others are already running in Florida and elsewhere. The thing about algae, though, is they grow a lot.
What do we do with that algae? You have to have an end use, otherwise you're going to pile that algae up very quickly.
Well, it is high in protein, May says. It's been turned into animal feed. It can be fermented into biofuels, and it makes a great fertilizer. But the University of Maryland's Stephanie Lansing has other plans.
So every week we harvest the algae. With that algae, we actually put it into an anaerobic digestion system.
Inside the digester, microbes break down the algae into methane biogas.
And then the biogas is used to run a fuel cell. The fuel cell is actually a very efficient way of using the energy. You can use it to charge batteries. You can use it for lights. You can use it for fans.
The Port of Baltimore plans a bigger system that could produce a modest amount of renewable electricity, a few hundred kilowatts. That's not bad when you start with just polluted water and algae.
It is beautiful and actually captures people's imagination because you can make that connection that algae is actually doing this work actively for you.
Nature put to work to make clean water and clean power. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Baltimore.
It gets dark during a total solar eclipse, and VOA's Rick Pantaleo takes a moment to tell us how bees react.
This is Science in a Minute.
On August 21st, 2017, a total solar eclipse followed a northwest to southeast path across the United States. A number of researchers from various scientific disciplines used the solar eclipse to conduct experiments. Researchers at the University of Missouri put together a group of citizen scientists along with elementary students and their teachers to study how a solar eclipse affects bees. 16 acoustic monitoring stations were placed along the total eclipse path in Oregon, Idaho, and Missouri. The monitoring stations were placed in locations where bees would congregate, such as flower patches. As the total eclipse made its way over each monitoring station, the researchers listened for the sound of bees buzzing, or as they found out, not buzzing. During the periods of totality, the bees took a break from their daily routines. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us at iTunes and SoundCloud. You'll find us on VOA Asia Facebook. And, of course, you'll find us at our website, voanews.com. You'll find us on the radio as well. CCU Radio at National Chung-Cheng University in Taipei, Taiwan has our program. If you happen to be listening there, thanks a lot for tuning in. Or wherever you may be hearing our program. We'd also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison, managing editor, Diane Gao. Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook make up our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day.